Hello, humans. It is me, Hannah Huddins. Last night, we had another ceremony beginning at 9 p.m., and I haven't slept since. This time, it was Dionysio's lovely wife, Aubrey, conducting the ceremony. Aubrey created a much more spiritual and ritualistic environment for us. She picked some large aromatic flowers from the property and placed them in the center of the maloka, along with incense and other ceremonial accoutrements. She had a large and pleasantly deafening singing bowl, an instrument that sounded like a babbling brook. It was all women in attendance this time. In order going around the maloka, it was Aubrey, myself, Mothership, Rachel, and Motsie. It's difficult for me to fathom putting my entire experience into words because it was beyond the capacity of language, infinite epiphanies, and immense deep healing at the atomic level. I saw Ma.
Joy Ma!
I saw Kali Ma! My entire trip was rejoicing in her infinite beauty and unconditional love. She is in absolutely everything. I felt her love and energy in all creatures, plants, minerals, and vast spaces in between. In this realm and planet and endless others.
I started to top the mountains and clean the springs up, pick all the pollution out of the water so I could drink it, clean up all the green things and pick up all the old beer cans and clean all the way to the ocean. And then maybe we might be able to save a little air and water for our children.
I can understand that bugs communicate. I can understand that trees can hear you. I understand that there are other life forms.
I continued to cry, weeping in the witness of her divinity even after the trip. She dances in my heart and she taught me how to love. She taught me how to live, how to truly be awake, and how to stay awake. She challenged me and embraced me. Aghori Baba Poglananda told me once in 2009 in Kathmandu that I would reach the highest state of consciousness in this lifetime. I was always somewhat skeptical of that grandiose proclamation, but alas, I was there! I believe I actually made it as he predicted, while he was deep in his white-eyed trance in the cremation grounds. I made it to Ma's home, in her lap with my brothers and sisters. Welcomed amongst the gods and goddesses. It's all within. Her palace is within all of us. Whenever I would start to slip away back into samsara, I called out her name, Kali Ma! And she let me back inside her celestial palace. She said I can come back inside any time, but implored me to go out and play. Go play in her backyard and be the wide-eyed child that I am. She gave me the gift of imagination at birth and told me to go out and use it. She allowed me to play out my fantasies for the future, and just when I thought it was written destiny, she showed me a completely different path. So many fortunate paths and gifts to choose from. She blessed me with all the tools to paint my chosen reality. She allowed me to see different ways I can worship her and help heal those who will remain blind to her love in this lifetime.
Yes, hello. I'm Jason Louv, and this is the 29th episode of the Ultra Culture podcast, this time starring Hannah Haddix, the world traveler, outsider artist, and my sibling of chaos. Hannah was my fellow student with Genesis Peorage. We both studied under Genesis at the infamous Gates Institute, also known as Jen's apartment complex in Ridgewood, New York, on the border of Queens and Brooklyn. Hannah and I both lived there in the mid-2000s, where I was learning magic from Genesis and Lady J, Peorage, and Hannah was first living at the apartment and then joined the band Psychic TV. And so we kind of grew up together in that sense as young wizards. If you're wondering what that cluster of loud noises you heard was, that was Hannah talking about her recent ayahuasca trip, which she's going to talk about at length in this episode. And you can blame Duncan Trussell for this because he has gotten me into the idea of making music for my own podcast, which I've been playing around with. which is actually super enjoyable. Okay, you're going to love this episode. Hannah and I cover a lot of ground. We talk about studying with Genesis. We talk about the role of the outsider artist and the coyote, the outsider magician in society. We talk about magic. We talk about ayahuasca. And we talk about the coming of artificial intelligence and inorganic consciousness and what this might do to us as a species. Hannah is one of my dearest magical friends, compatriots, and fellow travelers. And you're really, really going to love this conversation. Okay, and today's episode is brought to you by Magic.me, my school for magic, meditation, and shamanism. You can find it at magick.me, and I have courses there on every subject you can possibly imagine relating to the occult, everything from chaos magic to astral projection to hardcore yoga and meditation to lucid dreaming to using magic to fuel your artistic process and everything in between, including a couple of really awesome new courses, one full training on Enochian magic and one that I've called the 7-Day Magic Supercharger, which will take you from 0 to 10,000 miles an hour within 1 week. It's a brutal training regimen, so be prepared if you are brave enough to take it. You can start at magic.me for the very low introductory cost of free. There is a free 7-day email course, which will teach you all the basics. You can get that at free.magic.me/offer. That's magic with a K, magick.me. So free.magic.me/offer. And if you're ready to dive right in, now is definitely the time. I keep mentioning on this on the podcast, and I keep bringing this up, but the prices are about to go up. It's just that I'm juggling 10,000 things. And I haven't sat down to raise the prices yet, but it's going to happen any day now. That means that the lifetime package that is currently on magic.me is the best deal you will ever get on magic.me ever. It's going to be going away very shortly as soon as I clear my to-do list and get to removing it. It's very likely there is not going to be any lifetime package going forward, and it's never going to be that cheap again. Why am I raising my prices? It's because my own students are telling me to do it. They keep telling me, dude, you are giving away way too much for way too low of an amount of money. You're underselling yourself. We're concerned about you. Please, for the love of God, raise the prices. So I'm going to be doing that very shortly. Like I said, as soon as I clear my to-do list to do it. So last call, if you want that lifetime package, the best deal ever, now's the time to get it. Magic.me. Okay, so with no further ado, here's Hannah, and enjoy the show.
World outside the prison. Someone's got to be the bad guy. How can we be good guys?
It's true for the people that want it to be true. That's when you're dealing with the public. You deal the public off the bottom. You deal them what they want to buy and what they want to hear.
I want to appear like I'm somebody, but I'm on top of everything. I'm the smartest guy in the world.
Yes, hello. How's it going, Hannah?
Very good. Yes, hello, Jason.
Yes, hello. So I'm hanging out with my good friend Hannah Haddix in her penthouse art studio in Seattle. And Hannah and I have been friends for, how long have we been friends for now?
Well, we met in 2006, so 12 years?
12 years. That's a long time.
It is.
So Hannah, of course, is a illustrious artist and a world traveler and well-known in the occult scene and magus of the Coyotal Church and general instigator and, you know, Kali avatar in the often stuffy occult world and is there to mix things up and keep people on their toes at all times.
A daughter of chaos.
A daughter of chaos. And Hannah and I are, of course, siblings of chaos because we were both, what's the right word, you know, educated by Lady J and Genesis Peorage.
Yes.
And, you know, we both kind of lived with Jen and Jackie in Ridgewood, mm-hmm, in the 2000s. And at that time, Hannah was playing keyboards in Psychic TV, and I was...
Well, I was dating the keyboards of Psychic TV. I was doing the video projection. And then later, when Jay dropped her body, I took over her samples for an album. but it was Marcus who was playing the keyboards.
And then you just kind of like cut out the middleman there.
Well,
and went straight to playing keyboards.
No, I know. It was just the samples.
Oh, it was the samples.
It was the samples. I took Jay's spot for an album.
Okay. And then, and at that time, I was working on Generation Hex and then Ultra Culture and the Psychic Bible. And, you know, as you remember, I was just over there nonstop with, you know, talking to Jen and working on projects, talking magic.
The good old Gates Institute.
The Gates Institute in Ridgewood, New York. No longer there. But that was it was an amazing kind of like, I don't know, it's like an Addams Family type setup almost, right?
A bunch of misfits and troubled children going to get guidance from mother, father, mother, Jen, right. And Jay.
I'm curious, what are your main memories of that time? I'm curious.
Jackie in her garden, just being around them. And, you know, the things that they introduced me to as far as culture is concerned, when I first moved into the Gates Institute, I really didn't know anything about magic or the occult or the beautiful underbelly of the underworld where people are creating their own way and taking their identity into their own hands and like truly making like genuine art that's not stillborn or contrived. And just the being inspired by these bright beings that had so much charisma and really didn't give a fuck about what was going on outside of just them finding out who they truly are and living in such a way that facilitated their dreams and their being and their visions. It was I feel very fortunate to have found them at the, you know, the ripe age of 18, 19 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I first started, I think, interning for Jen when I was 23.
Yeah.
So, yeah, around the same. But 18 is pretty impressionable.
Quite. I was like, alien brains? Yes. I had no idea who Jen was when I first met her. She was sitting on the couch and she was just like, she was talking to me about the first conversation we had was about the artist Molière. The French photographer, I believe, who was dressing up in women's clothing and making really dark, sexy, just like exotic dark art. And I was like, you know, I had never been exposed to that outside of maybe some Joel Peter Witkin. But that was our first conversation. And I was like, love at first sight, you know?
Well, that house really was like a laboratory, right? Where it was like, like you were just saying, it was, you know, the people that were there, which was Jen, Jay, and then the other members of Psychic TV, and then people mm-hmm. who were connected,
right.
And then me, and I was not in the band, but I was working with Jen on publishing projects and there to learn magic, not for the music, right?
Right.
So, but that, like, I just remember everyone there, I mean, it was nonstop, right? It was like a factory for, you know, cultural production in a way.
Absolutely.
And it was a laboratory where people were like, as you were saying, like just trying to, you know, live art, you know, in a really, and people say that like, oh, I live my art and stuff like that. But this was like full, you know, like a full on alchemical laboratory.
Absolutely.
Like everything there, you know, was, you know, dedicated to being stormtroopers of evolution. Right?
Absolutely. Yeah. There was the basement where Jen kept the archive before it was sold to the Tate Museum. And there were just boxes of things with Burroughs effects, a sculpture that Burroughs did, which was a self-portrait, which is basically like a wooden box with a bunch of barbed wire and a basketball. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, I think he got that at the auction for, when that was Timothy Leary's, and Jen got it at the auction after Timothy Leary died.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. So then, yeah, it was absolutely a production facility. It's like there was always stuff going down, like going on in the basement, different projects, you know, like today we're going to silkscreen shirts for the Psychic TV tour. Today we're going to make rosaries to sell people. Like or we're going to go through and, you know, file the archive.
Or put that was usually my job, filing the archive.
Yeah. The more studious minds got to do that, while Marcus and I got to do the art stuff.
Well, I got to do a lot of sweeping and cleaning dishes, too. So
yes. There was the manual, general life labor of love.
So this is something that you, I mean, so I'm hanging out in your apartment now, which is very much like what I remember that being, where all your walls are covered with your collage art and there's, you know, occult stuff everywhere, saturated to a level beyond human comprehension in a way.
It's a bit overwhelming.
So you've clearly taken this forward in your own life and, you know, continued the process, right?
Absolutely. Undeniably so. I always felt like I've always been a creative person, and I've always felt a bit alien-brained compared to my peers, not even just my peers, but people in general. And I was always searching for a tribe. And when I met Jen and Jay and Topi, I found my family. And through Jen's teachings about the different tools one can use in order to get in touch with the muse or the holy guardian angel, like whatever you want to call it, but getting in touch with the thing inside of you that is pure and true and conversing with it. And for me, that's been art and the creative cut up process inspired by Burroughs and Geisen.
And those were the guys that taught Jen, who then taught us.
Yes. Right? Yeah. So it's just like, it's a lineage. And it's undeniable, the process. Well, you know, the process is the product, as Jen would say. Well, she got that from who?
From the process church, right? Or maybe it was Geisen.
I think it was Geisen. It was Geisen. Yeah.
Geisen wrote the book, The Process.
Yes. Right. Talking about the third mind.
No, that was the third mind with Burroughs.
Okay.
But The process, I really recommend that book, by the way. It was a novel that Geisen wrote where the bad guys are about being in North Africa, and then the bad guys are like a thinly veiled like representation of Scientology. Like,
oh my goodness.
I think it might have been connected to the Process Church in some way. I'm not sure. Or no, maybe I think Scientology is called the Process in that book. I don't know. It's been a long time since I read it, and I don't want to just ramble about it on the podcast. Right. But anyways.
Something to check out. But it is fascinating when I get into this creative space, this ritual creative space, where I allow the muse to take over. And I don't put a lot of thought, or I don't analyze what it is I'm doing. I just allow it to flow. And I cut things up, different like pornography or art books, science books, history books, magazines. And I cut things up and I just pay attention to form and color and the way that it feels and resonates. And then when I put it together, after I've glued it and, you know, closed my space, I look at these creations and I can see a reflection of something inside and the higher that's like, it's guidance, it's therapy, it's reflecting on what's going on inside. And sometimes it's just a mirror, or and sometimes it's like advice or looking into what needs to be done for whatever steps and goals I'm working on.
And that's a magical process for you.
It is.
And I'm guessing you also use collages to manifest things also.
Sure, sigils all the time. Yes, indeed.
And that works pretty well.
It does. Yes. I got to learn firsthand from Jen. We would do it every month, the three liquid sigil. And
just describe the sigil of three liquids for people who don't know what that
is. So every month on the 23rd at 11:23, which is 23:23, we would go into our own space and just have our talismans, whatever ritual objects we wanted. Jen was not very specific. She said, just whatever you need in your ritual space. And then we would make a piece of art. It could be a drawing. It could be a collage, a painting, a poem. You could just any physical representation of something that you want to manifest. We would have an intent. So you have your, you make something in a way that is a reflection of what you want to happen in the world. And sometimes we would make sigils where we would write out our intent and then make a sigil from it. Make that a component of the art. And then after that was completed would be the three liquid portion where we would apply our spit. We would cut ourselves and apply the blood. And then we would bring ourselves to orgasm. And at the point of orgasm, look at the thing that we had created. And we would utilize the power of the orgasm to then have our manifestation be like shot into the universe. It would be like accepted into the inbox of the universe.
That's okay. I like that. That's a good way of putting it.
Which would then, you know, resonate, be registered, and then unfold into our consensus reality.
And how have you seen those things unfolding into your reality in the past? How well does it work?
Well, it's definitely a process. That's what we did it for a year every month. And it was wonderful to do it on such a regular basis. And just once a month, because it gave us enough time and reflection to see how things unfolded and if it worked, and then to kind of tweak the things that we were creating and the intentions that we had, because sometimes it wouldn't manifest, and you know, it would come out in different ways. And there was all these unexpected elements that you don't think about when you're putting together a piece of art. Like you could have an element that you didn't really consider was a part of your intent, but it was just part of the art. And then it manifested in such a way that was like, but that's not really what I wanted. So it's a process of learning how to be specific in such a way that you don't limit yourself, but then again, you're not opening up the floodgates.
Okay, so that's actually really interesting. That gives kind of like a long manifestation time, a long lead time, because I know that with chaos magic sigils, like I went into sigils not through the Topi route, but through kind of the Peter Carroll, Liber Null route, where Austin Spare route, where it's like drawing like symbols and then doing, you know, in my case, maybe like 20 sigils a week or something like that, you know, and just like totally overdoing it. I remember Jen at one point saying to me like, well, no wonder your life was so chaotic. Whereas with this, it's once a month, which is actually like a pretty long time frame and enough to like get very clear about what you're doing and being much more reflective on what you're actually doing.
Exactly. So. And then also just seeing that it works, you know, you find the one thing that you want to focus on, your one intent, which is the most difficult part about the entire process, is deciding what it is that you want to focus on and put all that energy into in that month, in that one moment, in that ritual, but then to hope for it, or, you know, witness it unfold in whatever unexpected way. Just finding out and asking yourself, what is it that I want? What do I want to see in my life, in the world around me, in my interpersonal relations, in my, you know, in my creativity, in my finances? Just what is it that I want to focus on?
And you've ended up in a pretty unique life.
I have.
Right?
Yes. I'm just a cackling coyote on the edge of the abyss at all times, surrounded by chaos. I've realized through the process of finding out who I am through ritual magic that the things that are important to me are new experience, traveling the world, making new things, enjoying Ma's garden. I mean, here we are in Kali's garden, and there's endless possibilities and there's endless experiences, and I'm not complacent having the same one over and over again. You know, I have a saying, we must try everything at least 7 times.
That's okay.
So it's like, you know, you have to try all the things at least a couple times to like see if it works for you or not. But I just want to continue going new places, having new experiences, learning new things, new ideas, breaking all the taboos, and creating my way out of the shackles of societal expectations and just embracing the alien that I am.
Why is taboo breaking and taboo busting such an important part of magic?
Well, because you're not going to find out who you are if you allow others to wield your reality for you. And a taboo is basically society or a group of people saying, no, that's not okay, or that's unfavorable or forbidden. And what kind of, I mean, you're not a magician if you're not trying to create something new for yourself, to have a new understanding. And you have to push limits. There's like, in order to evolve, you must get out of your comfort zone. And breaking taboos and exploring the forbidden is a wonderful way to get out of your comfort zone.
What does that tend to do with your consciousness?
Breaking taboos?
Yeah, like so in my case, you know, doing things like that, it's it puts you in like in my experience of it, and I'm kind of fishing for it, what your take on this is my experience of taboo busting activities is it puts you in a kind of liminal zone where you have this brief window of, I guess, chaos, creative chaos is the right word. Phrase for it, maybe, where you're kind of pushed out of, you get to see outside of the boundaries of society, and it allows for little windows of freedom and kind of open potential. That's my experience of it, but I'm kind of curious what your take on that is, or what kind of your internal experience of those kind of anathema activities has been.
Well, it's incredibly liberating, but also isolating. And it, when you involve yourself in activities or realms of thought that are absolutely abhorrent to the masses, you are putting yourself in a space where you are one against the world. And that is, it's a very evolutionary place to be, because it allows you to sever the comfort ties and the things that you rely on in society that keep you stagnant or, you know, foggy brained. Like, when you are one against the world, you have to be, you know, aware and alert and like just have confidence in who you are. You have to be strong. You have to be a warrior. It puts you in warrior stance, which I think is a good place to be if you want to, you know, I don't want to say power up. That sounds ridiculous, but.
No, not necessarily. I mean, it's pretty direct and straightforward.
Yeah. It's a nice place to visit, but I think spending all of your time there can be a little bit damaging.
Well, let's talk about this, right? Because, you know, one thing that we see, and obviously we've both been doing magic for a long time, like long before the current phase of it becoming so much better known and trendy in some ways, right?
Sure.
Is that magic is, you know, look, like when I first started getting into magic, it's like the people who were involved in it, I mean, you know, like, and even before coming to before meeting Jen and, like, you know, the Gates Institute and all that, it really was like a few people against the world. But more than that, it was also like magic, like, was always like a wrong side of the tracks activity, which also, if you look at like Indian texts and Tantra and things like that, it always has been. It's like something that happens, like it's an activity of outsiders who are like totally outside of the consensus reality. And I remember like first, like when I first got into chaos magic in the, I was talking to William Kiesel about this recently, actually. When I first got into chaos magic in the late 90s and the early 2000s, like the people that I was meeting were like scary,
right?
Like scary as in like, not like, ooh, like Darth Vader edgelordy, but just like really sketchy people.
Gotcha.
You know, yeah. Like there's like with, you know, like hard drugs, like, you know, like, yeah. like crazy nom vets who, sure, were like into like, you know, like heroin smuggling and shit. Like it like you met like some real strange people in the occult. And one of the things I realized is that at that time was that a lot of the people who were into the occult were there because they were already, it's not like they had followed like an academic track to get there. They were there because
they were already outcasts.
Yeah, like they were already outcasts, yeah, and they just needed somewhere to go.
Sure.
You know, like they were already on the total fringes and outskirts of reality.
Absolutely.
And that's just kind of where they gravitated to because those were the other people that were there.
Sure.
And it's like not, kind of not that way anymore, where suddenly it's like super trendy and like everyone thinks they're,
it's fashionable to be a witch.
Yeah. I don't have anything to do with that situation. It's not my fault, I promise.
I'm blaming you, Jason. What did you do?
What did I do? But the reason I bring that up in terms of what you were saying is that, you know, part of magic has been really severing ties with the mainstream reality and then of course creating your own reality, but that's a pretty hard path.
It is.
You know? So I'm just curious.
It's a lonely path, but it's the most rewarding path.
Why is it the most rewarding?
Because being true, knowing who you are and being true to who you are, I think that that's, I mean, what could be more rewarding than that? But this is just my own reality tunnel. I'm sure some people think that, you know, physical riches or, but I mean, you can have all those things. There's no limitation to who and what you can be. And every person, if they follow their will, is going to be different because, I mean, we're all stars.
In the dope show.
Yes.
Well, I remember like in the, at Jen's place, you know, like I always kind of stuck out in a way because I was always the most normal looking person in the sense that like I don't have any tattoos, right. I don't have any piercings. I would just always kind of look like this nerdy computer guy, you know, like
you were so aloof and mysterious though.
Shy, but yeah. I've kind of maintained that because my approach to magic has always been, yeah, like my approach to magic has always been like very scientific in a way. And but kind of like Burroughs, like I was always inspired by Burroughs, would always dress in a suit and like he'd dress like a banker, sure, like a Midwest bank manager.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of, my take has always been, there's a lot of power in not just getting out of the consensus trance, but being able to move among reality tunnels.
Absolutely.
Like, you know, like I remember, you know, that like my take has been that I should be able to, you know, be totally like, you know, doing some insane ritual activity and then the next day, you know, walk into like an ad agency and get a job or something like,
sure,
that, you know, which I've done. So my take on magic has always been, well, like you were saying, you know, Ma's garden, like Kali's garden, like there's infinite experiences. So I've tried to kind of shape and actualize my life in a way that I can just walk through as many parts of the garden as possible.
Sure. Absolutely. That makes perfect sense. I think there's something really beautiful and powerful to be a total freak, but just blend it like you just look like a person on the street and people don't know until, you know, they get to know you or they ask you a question or you open your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
It takes people by surprise. And not all of us are exhibitionists and not all of us feel like we need to like dress and like show ourselves to the world as an art piece, you know, or as a freak. There is something really powerful and beautiful just to like slink on by.
Yeah, I think Jen said at one point, you know, I think everyone was kind of making fun of me for looking so normal. And then Jen was saying, like, it's okay. I'm satisfied that he's bizarre on the inside.
Oh, sweet Jen.
Yeah. So, okay. So I want to ask you, I'm really curious about this. So you've been around the occult scene for what, like 15 years now, right? And so you have, I'm sure, interacted with like tons of male occultists.
Oh yes, so
and
many.
their fantasies and projections and delusions.
Oh sure.
And I'm really curious about your, and if you don't mind, I want to ask you about this a little bit, because I think that, you know, it's like, look, the occult in so many ways just plays into male power fantasies. Let's be honest, right?
Sure.
There's so much of it is like from Crowley to chaos magic is like this idea of kind of like, you know, being the super edgy, well, either not even just edgy, but, you know, like that you're going to get some type of power and kind of like phallic power, and that you're going to be like the darkest of the dark and the most powerful sorcerer and all this. And it's just so obviously like a power fantasy that a teenage or early 20s male would have, right?
Sure, absolutely.
And you know, is certainly something that I went through, but, you know, and Jen was very, and Jen went through, you know, yeah. Let's be fair. And, but that, you know, Jen very clearly, you know, pointed to a much more evolved and community-based version of that. But I'm really curious, like, what the occult looks like from your perspective, because obviously not being female,
yes.
You know, I really want to know what the occult world looks like, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly from your perspective.
Well, you know, at this point, when I meet somebody who's interested in the occult and who's working with it, even if they are coming from it from a goofy standpoint where they are into, like, I don't want to say the Goetia is goofy, but, you know, like, if they're coming, they're doing certain things that I think are probably on a lower frequency of magic, I still have respect for them, just for the fact that they are actively doing something to understand themselves. I've met a lot of people in the occult who are trying to get power over people, or it's manipulative and it's like their intentions are shitty, and it's not about evolving themselves. It's just about like being a man child and inflicting their weird fantasies on the world around them. But I don't think those people would get really far, because it's not based in, you know, you have to work on yourself, and you have to work on knowing who you are and expressing who you are honestly and facing yourself in the mirror before you can actively and legitimately, you know, affect the things and the people around you. And the people who do the work to see themselves are probably at that point not going to want to be like a arms flailing man child who's like, you know, summoning demons so that he can, you know, start a sex dungeon or something, you know.
That always seems to be the fantasy.
that is quite the fantasy. I try to follow the advice that Jen gave me many years ago. She gave me a mantra that has stuck with me for the entire past decade, and I keep it in mind. And she there are three things that one must accomplish in order to not have any disappointments in life, and it's no judgments, no expectations, and no attachments. And so when it comes to dealing with the world around me, whether it's occult bros or like trend witches or people,
occult bros and trend witches, that's beautiful, Hannah.
Thanks. Whether it's dealing with people like that, or just, you know, just people who just care to watch their television, play their sport, or watch their sports and do their 9-to-5s, you know, I try to not have any judgment. Like, I'm working hard on just being understanding and compassionate, because I've realized that we all have our different reality tunnels. We're all at different states of our personal evolution. And sure, I could stand around all day and criticize and crack jokes, and sometimes it's fun to do so. But like, when it comes down to it, I really just like, I hope that people can do better and be better and find ways to express themselves and be creative and find what makes them happy and what is good for our planet. But, you know, people are really misguided right now. And the more I delve into thoughts of that, it makes me sad for humanity. It does.
Well, you have a very compassionate view of that. And I like that your attitude of, or what you were saying earlier of, you know, even if somebody is coming at the occult from like a kind of, like an early stage of like kind of, even if they're in it in a tacky way, mm-hmm. at least they're trying, right? At least they're doing work, right. Which is like what 99.9999% of people like never do. Exactly. As you say, they just sit in front of the TV or right. Netflix or Facebook or whatever. And so, you know, yeah. And it's like, and the hope is that they will keep going and continue to evolve.
Right.
So thanks for the reminder to be like,
yeah, just yeah. Encourage them and maybe give like constructive advice instead of criticizing them to the point where they get discouraged and they just go back to being complacent and just being consumers instead of creators. You know, it's like, we all started off not knowing who we are and
yeah.
with our own, you know, we're all human and like humans are selfish and humans are confused and like we're not whole, you know, we're not complete people. We have pain and suffering and so it's, you can't expect somebody to get into it and immediately be a virtuous, ethical, you know, magician.
Right. Well, I've definitely gotten twitchy in the past because just like interacting with, you know, as I've interacted with so many people who are, you know, doing, whether it's Gaweisha or other stuff, or doing things to, like you said, you know, control or, you know, do dark sided kind of things, you know, and I've ended up with like a really short fuse about it.
Sure.
But I get what you're saying in terms of being kind of like, you know, at least trying to, it's an optimistic view that people will evolve from there. Will they, in all cases? Probably not, let's be
fair.
But
not.
Some of them hopefully will.
Hopefully.
So, okay, so you talked about humanity and the state of the world. We were talking recently about a trip you did to Peru.
Yes.
And some experiences that you had. And I'm wondering if you were interested or if you want to talk about that.
Sure.
Okay. So you were talking about you had had a vision in an ayahuasca retreat. Is Peru, right?
Yes.
And about how technology is going to affect the world. Maybe you can tell the story because I really like this.
Oh my goodness. Okay, yes.
Or I thought it was beautiful and amazingly put. I don't like what you were seeing happening to the world, but I like your description of your vision.
So I went to Peru and I took ayahuasca every other day for 8 days straight with my mother. And during the second ceremony, I had the most intense experience, and really compared to the other trips, it was, I mean, okay. So during this, ceremony, it's started off. Yes.
First off, maybe, so I've never taken ayahuasca.
Okay.
So maybe if you could give us a description of what that is like, what the process of like is like going into.
Okay. Our ayahuasca ceremonies were not very traditional. Usually it's like people are singing karos and there's lots of, you know, drumming and music and there's a shaman doing all the things. But this was more, so we were in a maloca, a circular structure in the jungle, and it was me and maybe like six other people, all in a circle. We were on our mats. It was at night. We started at night around 9 p.m. And we sit silently. The ayahuasquero, her name was Aubrey, was a woman. In this particular ceremony, it was just women, which was really, you know, I think it added to the experience that I had. I had some misogyny curing experiences.
How do you mean?
Before this ayahuasca ceremony, I was a bit of a misogynist. I didn't get along with women. I didn't trust them. I would surround myself with men. I just was kind of disparaging towards women. And then I had a vision in which I saw the mother of the universe. I saw God as Kali Ma. And she told me that that women are the fruit of the earth, and that if you attempt to put your feet under the feet of your sisters, you're only going to trip yourself up in the process. And it was very curing and very, like, it's really fascinating to me that this drug is so powerful that it could rewrite in one evening an entire lifetime of ill feelings towards the female race. And going out of that and having that healing and seeing that and knowing it in deep inside the intrinsic parts of my understanding, then to walk away from that and have open arms towards women and not be catty or judgmental or fall into a space where I am fall into a space where I am not giving them as much respect as I would give a man, you know, just general misogyny. I was a misogynist, a female misogynist. Fancy that. So the process of the ceremony. So we're all sitting in a circle and we're administered the medicine, which is in a liquid form. It's made from two vines that are found in the Amazon, a kapi vine and another, which I don't remember. And you drink the medicine, and it takes about anywhere from like 30 minutes to an hour to hit you. It lasts for about 8 to 10 hours. And yeah, we just sat in the circle and had these visions. And so, but we had our freedom to, like, you know, get up and leave if we wanted to walk around the jungle or we need to get in our own space. And during this intense vision, when I saw God, I saw Ma, and I was welcomed into her celestial palace. And I had visions of my mother who was there, and I dealt with my mom's death. It was a long thing.
The idea that your mom would at some point die in the future.
No, she died. Like, she got up. I watched. Well,
but it, just to clarify, in the vision, not. You know,
yeah, in the vision.
Your mom was actually there and your mom is still alive.
My mom was. She's still alive.
I just wanted to clarify that for the listener.
She's still alive. We just got back from Greece. My mother, she wasn't dealing with the experience well, and her defense mechanisms were kicking in so intensely that she was audibly sleeping during the ceremonies. And so at one point I was like, Mom, like, wake up. This is a ceremony. This isn't time for sleeping. Like, this is a time to face your demons and deal. And she was like, she said, no, I'm too, like, it's too scary for me. I'd rather just sleep. I can't deal. And so she went back to sleep and she started snoring again. I had a vision of my mother then leaving the Maloka, stripping naked, vomiting and expelling her bowels, and then walking into the jungle and to die. And I thought for sure that this was happening. And that was her walk of shame that Ma made her do because she wasn't willing to face herself in this lifetime. And then I went through the grieving process of her death and figuring out, like, what am I going to do? Like, I'm in Peru. What am I going to do with her body? Like, who am I going to tell first? It's a very visionary, crazy journey. Lots of healing, lots of confronting things in the past and the future, because, you know, time is not linear and it's all happening at once. But I had a vision that you originally asked about. So I was recruited for war. Ma had recruited me for war against these aliens that were trying to take over Earth, basically, like, not terraform it, but, like, I guess it would be alien form it. And they were doing so by cold circuitry and technology, and insidiously over time, not only getting into our biologies through, like, aluminum and deodorant and different metals that we deal with, but through the technology and through, like, artificial intelligence. And I saw that this is sad for me, because I used to be all about space and just wanting to go to space. But I saw that if we develop the technology necessary to colonize other planets, it'll be allowing them to take over in such a way that we would lose the things that make us human: our spontaneity, our compassion, our creativity. It's like they're trying to make us these, like, metallic, robotic, emotionless, non-humans. They're basically, I saw that they're trying to take over planet Earth.
But the vision was kind of the natural world being overwritten by technology.
Yes.
And the machine.
Yeah. Right? Taking over by the machines. And I know this is going to sound cheesy as all hell, but the only power that we had to fight them was love. And I had to, like, shoot beams of love at these aliens, and it was my job to make sure the sun came up, and I had to fight the aliens all night. And it was like, in that moment, we were at war, and I mean, the sun came up, so I think that's a good sign.
I would have been quite upset if the sun had never come up again, and then I found out that it's because you were supposed to fight the aliens and had not been successful. So thank you for succeeding in that war.
You have no idea.
I'm rather reliant on the sun.
It was my responsibility. It was all my shoulders to stay up until the sun came up fighting the aliens. So you can all thank me. Yes, you're very welcome. I did it. I rose the sun on that day, and I've never been so happy to see the sun, I got to tell you.
But I've experienced similar things through magic and in my 20s, and kind of seen perhaps a similar timeline. Whether it's, you know, literal aliens or, you know, whatever it is, it's like a way of us understanding that, you know, that it would be, I think it would be fairly easy for the human race to end up in a potential future of pure soullessness, mm-hmm. of pure technology. And a complete, I mean, just with a, not just devastated, but a no longer existent natural world, and with human beings becoming kind of like slaves of algorithms.
Totally.
Instead of, you know, full human beings. And that's one of the things that's so important about magic and what you're doing and all this, is like kind of keeping alive and reminding people that human life doesn't have to be optimized, you know, that it's like, it doesn't have to be like fit some type of pattern, that, like, you know, I think one of the greatest things about humans is that we can be totally like chaotic and confusing and messy and like good and evil and dark and light and just like, you know, change on a whim and be chaotic and unpredictable.
Totally.
And that, like, pure human chaoticness is deeply upsetting to the algorithmic thinkers and people who want everything to be perfectly clean and optimized.
Right.
And human life should be dirty and messy and
there
dangerous.
Are no straight lines on humans. It's like, you know, we have to embrace the beast. We have to embrace, like, the flesh pods that we are and the gooey experiences that we have. It's not a fine metallic surface.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So, I completely, I was very fascinated by your vision. And the thing about aluminum, it was you had said something that sounded strange at first, but then I actually started thinking about it, which was, if, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was that the finger hold that the inorganic universe has gotten over the organic in human world is that we're constantly putting aluminum into our bodies.
Yeah, I stopped using aluminum deodorant. I saw that if I continued to use aluminum deodorant, that I would have like thyroid cancer and die painfully. It was a thing. It was like, oh, this is really unhealthy, and there's no reason to be putting these hard toxic metals in my pores.
But it was also that it was like subtly and like an almost kind of homeopathic way, like attuning us to the inorganic and machine.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. It's making our biologies adapt to. It's like the slow, insidious merging of the organic and the inorganic.
So just stop using deodorant.
Yes,
and,
please,
and
throw away
your stink.
There are aluminum free deodorants.
Tom's of Maine.
Schmitz is a good one. That's what I use. But yeah, throw away your deodorant, aluminum deodorant, please, world.
Interesting.
Yes.
Well, I want to keep talking, but unfortunately, we're getting to the end of a sound card because I'm up in Seattle and the sound card is filled with my talk that I just gave. But we will have to continue the conversation on another podcast.
Yes, indeed.
And talk about, because there's a lot to talk about.
So many things to say. 12 years of experiences.
So thank you. And if people want to find out more about you, where should they go?
I have a website. It's rarely updated, but there's a lot of information. It's www.hannahhaddix.com. HannahHaddix.
And I'll put the link in the show notes.
Excellent.
And you're on social media.
Yes. Hannah Haddix on Facebook, Skin Slippers on Instagram.
All right. Hannah, thank you for doing the podcast with me.
Yeah, good to talk to you as always, Jason.
All right, I'll talk to you soon.
Goodbye.
Okay, thank you for listening. Definitely make sure to subscribe to the show so that you can get timely updates and new episodes as they're released. They're coming pretty fast and furious now. You can subscribe on Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and lots more. You can go to the podcast page at jasonlouv.com/podcast to find all of the previous episodes and places you can subscribe right there. Definitely check out magic.me and snap up that lifetime offer while it's still there. You only have a few more days left to claim it. And I will see you next week for the next episode of the podcast. All right. Lots of love to you. I honor you and see you soon.